If you're a barbell coach or trainer interested in learning more about the mechanics of lifting, or struggles with programming a client through pain to peak performance, or communication skills to effectively gather intel on your client's previous injuries, this podcast is for you. The Alinea Coaches Podcast exists to elevate strength and conditioning coaches, as well as personal trainers to the highest degree. Co-hosts and barbell coaches turned doctors of physical therapy, William Mills and Joey Rosie, interview coaches and trainers from around the globe on improving mechanics, communication, and programming to better serve their clients as a new line of fitness professional.
All right. So this is Doc Mills. I'm a physical therapist. Today I'm going to be chatting with Xavier Holt. He is a personal trainer and currently a student physical therapist. How much longer do you have in school?
A year and a half. Well, depending on how this whole situation goes, I should be graduating May of 2021, but
we're in the middle, for context, in case you're listening to this after the fact, we're in the middle of Corona quarantine. Mm-hmm. So lots of uncertainty, but that's okay. It's a little less, I'm trying to find positivity in the fact that everyone, like literally everyone, has uncertainty and it's not just me. So I'm trying to step back from that woe is me type thing, because everybody's feeling it and it's just a bunch of different flavors. 100%. But tell us about your background. So you were saying right before we started, you were a biology major in undergrad and you worked at a gym. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So just a brief background. In undergrad, I was pre-medicine. I originally wanted to go to medical school and get my MD. So I was a bio major with a chemistry minor. And then my senior year, decided to switch to pre-PT. I took the MCAT and applied to medical schools, did an internship with an MD, and didn't like it at all. Like the way the patient care was, you know, I didn't really spend that much time with the patients. So then I started shadowing some PT, fell in love with it, applied to PT schools, and got in my senior year of undergrad. And with the school outside of that, I worked at a gym all through undergrad, did some training. That's what I enjoyed as a hobby. And then went to PT school, got certified as a personal trainer the summer between undergrad and PT school, and then doing some personal training along during school, kind of like a side job.
Gotcha.
When I could.
Yeah. Cool. And how's that been going? So I'll say from my experience, and we were talking about this before we hit record, whenever I was in school, I thought, and this could be really in any school, because I have a bunch of friends who are trainers and still in undergrad, similar to how the situation I was in whenever I was in undergrad and coaching CrossFit from 2012 to 2014. I thought I didn't have any free time, right? And I was like devoted to school because I had to maintain a GPA to get into PT school. And then once I got into PT school, same thing. I didn't think I had any free time. So I trained people minimally and realized after the fact that I could have been capitalizing on certain things that I'm doing now in my physical therapy practice, applying it to training people. So how have you found that balance both from an undergrad and grad school standpoint?
So really just hearing that, I was in a very similar situation, first starting out, you know, transitioning from undergrad rigor to PT school rigor. I really thought I had no free time. And so I was doing a minimal amount of clients. I was training at the undergrad campus gym here because there's the medical school campus and the undergrad campus, but the gym is on the undergrad campus. So I'd have to drive there to train clients. So again, a couple of clients a week doing that. And then when I'm on clinicals, it was a little bit easier with the remote training. And now with this, also with the remote training, it's a little bit easier, but it's also more difficult with some of my clients that are power lifters or bodybuilders, find the equipment they need to...
For remote training, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, for doing those kind of things, and since they don't have access to gyms now. So this presented an opportunity as far as virtually training clients and being able to have more clients, but also presents a lot of difficulties as far as equipment and available space and being able to create programming for these people to reach the goals they need to reach without having the available equipment.
So I wanted to talk about that later, but we'll talk about it now. Okay. Cause this is a good segue. So you were doing, just to clarify, you were doing remote programming prior to quarantine. Yes.
Yeah. Minimally, but yeah.
Okay. So how has that changed? So basically you would say the most that has changed is your clientele base was more powerlifters and bodybuilders, and now they're struggling to load themselves while at home.
Yeah. So finding, you know, like, cause some of these guys, you know, are in the 300, 400, 500 pound ranges, you know, and you can do something like lift the couch or something like that, but being able to really load the tissue to the extent they were was almost impossible.
Right.
So trying to being realistic with them and letting them know that, you know, we might be able to maintain as far as progressing your strength during this time period. I'm going to be realistic with them, but it's definitely difficult to find even just random household objects to try to attempt to mimic the resistance and tissue load you would have.
Yeah. So what have you been doing? Do they have, so I'm in a similar situation with my, with my fitness athletes. I do remote programming as well. And I've been doing it for about a year. And it's probably one of the few reasons that I'm not freaking out about quarantine, because I shut down my in-person practice for 3 weeks until April 13th or potentially longer. Cause I didn't want to be a part of spreading corona. So I moved my current patients to telehealth, or if you're a trainer, you're probably calling it virtual visits. Pretty much the same thing.
Yeah.
Talking to someone over a screen. When you're a physical therapist, you have to jump through more hoops to be HIPAA compliant, which is not fun. But yeah, it's an interesting dynamic. It was challenging whenever I first started. Most of my treatment styles have always been communication based and movement based. So it wasn't as hard for me to transition to programming and doing more remote evaluation type stuff for wellness purposes. But it's tough to it's tougher for some people to communicate through a screen, or, you know, not be able to do tactile cues on someone to teach them how to hinge. So how have you worked through that with, you know, continuing to assess your lifters while away?
So there's kind of two situations. Some clients just want the typed up workout template programming, and some want the virtual conversations and workouts live. So with those clients, it is kind of an awkward interaction, especially for the ones that have never had it before. Mm-hmm. So one thing I try to do is never let there really be an awkward silence. If they're performing a movement or doing an exercise, I constantly try to either encouragement as many cues as I possibly can.
Yeah.
On everything, not too overcomplicated, not too many instructions, but just so there's constant verbal feedback, because they're not listening to music, they're trying to hear you. So as long as there's no awkward silence, I think it makes it easier for them to enjoy it and be more compliant, not feel as awkward or weird about this new way of interacting that we're going to have to do for the time being.
Do you have them do wireless headphones?
So some of them do have that. Some have to have like their laptop set up on a counter.
Right.
And like walk up to the screen so they can hear you.
I always find that's more awkward. I always encourage my people. I tell people, if you have a phone stand that's movable, that's a better preference for me.
Great idea. Yeah.
Cause you can move it around more. And then if you have wireless headphones, it's basically, you just need to be full body in the shot. And I'm like Jiminy Cricket on your shoulders telling you what to do, you know?
Yeah, that's definitely a good idea for sure.
So you were saying, don't let there be awkward silence.
Mm-hmm.
And then what?
Then, yeah. So So that's like my first thing is trying to keep a conversation, and not even a conversation, just actively coaching throughout the entire session to make sure there's no silence, to let them know that you're engaged, you're paying attention to everything they're doing. And then just going along with that, making sure they're talking back to me. So I tell them, like, try to make this a conversation like if we were in person, you know, like, hey, this feels kind of weird. Am I doing this correctly? Like, be actively engaged as if I was there in person with you. Trying to work on these things. Just to make it feel, try to make them feel more comfortable, I think is really, because it's a new thing for everybody. And the more comfortable they get, the quicker it'll have a more positive impact, I think, on their training.
So what has the conversation been with your heavier lifters that have the minimal equipment? Like, how have you been, encouraging them to not think that they're going to lose all their gains? So how their deadlift is not going to plummet by 200 pounds in the span of 3 or 4 weeks.
So this is kind of where the PT, the physical therapist student in me, comes into, as far as like recent classes we had on like different exercise, the way tissues adapt and regress and progress, you know, like just explaining to them, like, research shows, like, yeah, you know, you're going to atrophy a little bit, but it's not all going to be gone. That's not how it works. It's there in the literature. You know,
you're
not,
you would have to literally, you would literally have to not get out of bed.
Yeah, bed bound for four weeks. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's not that dramatic. If we're providing some kind of stimulus to the tissue, it's not going to go away. So I start with like the real conversation of, unless you are lucky enough to have a home gym, if that equipment's not available, we're going to do the best we can to maintain or limit how much you regress. And then it also, I try to make it a positive. I'm like, this gives us an opportunity to work on other things besides just your strength. I'm like, we can focus on mobility. We can focus on those areas that are some nagging injuries. Like, you know, your left hip's been tweaked for a little while. We can kind of focus and see, okay, how's your mobility on that hip? Let's do some mobility exercises. Let's take a little bit of the stress we've been putting on that tissue. Use this time to let it, that little injury, whatever it may be, calm down, heal, whatever needs to happen.
Deload, reload.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe you work on your cardiovascular a little bit, you know? Some of my powerlifter guys an overall health perspective, you know, would hurt to try to get that heart rate up a little bit more than for when you're doing a one rep max kind of thing, you know?
Right. Anything over three reps is cardio for a powerlifter.
100%. And then there's a 5 minute break after that. So, so I just, you know, I'm realistic with them, let them know that this is, it's the reality of the situation, but it does, it provides an opportunity for them to work on things that they wouldn't usually focus on as far as their training and rehabilitation goes and everything.
Sure. What kind of, I know for me, I'm sitting here watching videos of my athletes with minimal equipment. I have one guy who took one of his chest of drawers and put like bags of protein in it. He only had like one 10 or 15 pound kettlebell and then several books, and he was doing snatch grip deadlifts with that, and then wide grip pressing. And I was like, that's fantastic. Now, it's not going to be that much, but I've been encouraging people with the more you can make something awkward in this type of scenario, like the more it's not just this straight linear bar that we're used to, or a straight linear dumbbell that requires a little bit more stability, but it's still not super awkward. The more awkward you can make it, the more you're going to be working things that you probably haven't. And it's really good for you, you know,
in the sense of
things that feel awkward usually don't have to be as heavy to feel heavy, you know? So I've been encouraging people with that. They seem to be holding strong to it. But, you know, the thing is that in this kind of scenario, I found it's also important to help them check out, kind of like we had said before, check out of their, not pity party, but like helping them take a step back from this is everyone's reality right now, so you might as well make the most of it. And that's been beneficial. That's been powerful in terms of getting people to chill out and, yeah, and stay active, because there's a lot of people that, you know, find their motivation to work out by going to the gym. I'm that way. I have never worked out at home. I've never been motivated to work out at home. I'll make every excuse in the book to not work out at home. So that's been a shift for me, just because the gym's closed, right? Mm. What about you?
I agree 100%. Yeah, I mean, like between powerlifting and bodybuilding kind of exercising, because that's predominantly what I do.
Yeah.
I can say the same. I've never done a home workout. Transitioning to doing these home workouts was like a huge transition for myself. And I tell my clients that too. I mean, like, we're all kind of in the same boat making this transition. So we might as well make the best out of what we can. But I've definitely struggled with it. But, you know, you always got to have the positive outlook.
Right. Yeah. Cool. So let's see. I'm looking at my notes for what we had wanted to talk about. Okay. Adjusting programming for home workouts, especially for your clients and friends. So we've been chatting about that. What else have you been struggling with recently? Or, you know, not even recently. What is something that, from a trainer perspective, you've struggled with as a whole that you could benefit someone else by sharing the struggle?
For me, I think
outside of Corona.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just my confidence in being a personal trainer.
Yeah.
You know, cause like, I don't have like a ton of clients, you know, like I have like clients, but not like hundreds. And I mean, I wouldn't be able to handle hundreds, but my confidence in being a client, cause the more I learn in PT school, the more I realize I don't know. So like the more I learn, the more I realize I have to learn.
Right.
Kind of thing. So it affects my confidence of what I'm like, am I really giving this client the most optimal plan? Am I doing what's best for them as far as their goals go? Because with the personal training certification, you get a good foundation as far as that information goes. But
and like, which one are you? Which one NASM, do you
have? NASM CPT right now. I'm working on my CSCS, which is a little bit, I think it's a little bit more as far as like the information that you're presented with that.
Yeah, it's a little bit more dense.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to get that one too, just to make sure I have my bases covered in both.
Sure.
But yeah, so just my confidence in what I'm giving my clients being the most optimal training plans. And then I kind of try to take a step back and say, you know, like realize like I have that education, I have that experience, and just kind of like, you know, like being honest with myself that you can do that. And you probably are. Just, you know, don't second guess yourself so much. So that's definitely, I would say, is my number one struggle.
Sure.
As far as at this level.
Yeah, I feel that. I would say that doesn't stop.
Yeah.
So it's good to start to get comfortable with it now. It's interesting because from a trainer perspective, you know, whenever I was a CrossFit coach, I would say I was like a Kelly Starrett fiend. Like at the time, K-Star was big in the CrossFit world. I kind of took everything that he said as law and didn't really question it. And as a trainer, I wasn't really afraid to try stuff. And, you know, he said it worked, so it was probably going to work. Usually worked with my people. But the more I was exposed to research and I guess the art of critical thinking, in PT school. And that's not to say like you absolutely do not have to feel as a trainer that you need to go to PT school to be a good trainer. No. Right. No. That is 100% what neither of us are saying. But if you, you know, if you're looking to seek more knowledge, there's always going to be more knowledge out there. Mm-hmm. It's good to vet those from a pure trainer perspective. It's good to vet those continuing education type of things in the sense of, you know, you're thinking objectively. And I would say, unless you just had a really solid mentor that was like a Jedi master as a trainer, I was never really encouraged to think critically about what I was saying or doing. I was kind of just, you know, I thought what I was doing was most correct, so I just rolled with it, right? So it was interesting whenever I got to PT school that I was met with the idea of critically thinking and challenging my own biases, and it was super uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because I was like, well, shit, a lot of this isn't as true as I thought, right? Mm-hmm. So having a good lens of, you know, people you follow on Instagram. I try to say, if the people that you're following on Instagram are basically claiming to have all the answers, and they're not in the least bit saying, you know, this could go either way, probably not the safest person to follow, because then it kind of turns into this like guru type relationship, and you don't want a fitness coach or a strength and conditioning coach to be your guru. You want them to be like your objective source of disseminating knowledge, right? Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's you should go to, personally, I think you should go to a personal trainer is someone to learn from and help you. Mm-hmm. And then take that knowledge and apply it yourself and be able to go forward with those principles. And use that in your everyday life.
Right.
And when I say that, like, if you want to keep a trainer long-term, absolutely. If you need that extrinsic motivation and everything, but like my goal as a trainer is to be able to teach someone like these principles and based off their goals so that they can do it on their own without me having to be there the whole time. You know,
right.
Like I want you to be able to accept that lifestyle and those changes.
Right. Yeah. I spoke with another trainer. She's out in San Diego. She's a coach at CrossFit Invictus. And we talked about the Dunning-Kruger effect. Have you heard of that?
Mm-mm.
So the Dunning-Kruger effect is basically it's like a graph or a chart of what you just explained. Basically, the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. So before you're met with the fact that you might not know everything, your confidence is here. And then you start to learn stuff, and then it starts to plummet, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you reach this rock bottom point whenever you're kind of at the peak of realizing that this is going to be a knowledge journey for life. Mm-hmm. And then typically, have you ever heard of imposter syndrome?
Yep.
So that's typically when you get the imposter syndrome feelings. Okay. You start to question, hey, is what I know really correct?
Mm-hmm.
Do I, you know, what else do I need to know? Like, you start to have all these questions, you start to second guess yourself. And then after a while, you start to climb back out of it and you start to kind of find your groove. But I think it's a very interesting phenomenon in the sense of, if you feel it, then you're like, oh wow, I'm never going to stop learning, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. Right. Learning things that you learned 6 or 7 years ago probably are still applicable today, but they're always evolving because science is evolving, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I wasn't aware of that before I got hit with the idea of what imposter syndrome is. I was having all these feelings, but nothing to put into
label,
words.
Label it as.
Yeah, label. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. For sure. So you're in the midst of that.
Yeah, sounds like it. Yeah.
Doubled by the uncertainty of quarantine life.
Yep. Yeah. Shifting to completely online courses as far as physical therapy school goes is a pretty hard situation as far as learning those hands-on skills. So we'll see.
Sure. Okay. I had a question whenever we were in the middle of that Dunning-Kruger effect thing. What sources, whenever you were a trainer or in the midst of kind of transitioning to PT school, who are your go-to sources for information outside of your NASM certification?
So that's the thing that's kind of changed since I've been in school too. You know, like you find these people online that are claiming to be like the experts and everything. And what I knew then, I was like, oh, I'll go to these people. So it was like bigger names in the fitness industry, like your Steve Cooks and guys like that. Yeah. Just like going to their accounts, seeing what they're talking about, bodybuilding.com forums, going to like articles they present and everything. Just like the bigger names that have like the more aesthetic profiles that like, to me at that time, being a college student who was into working out, that's who I was going to, like outside of the certifications. Like, these guys look great. They post these transformations of their clients that seem to be really good. They must be doing something right. Transitioning to PT school, the school itself sometimes will give us like accounts that they think present good information. As far as people to follow, and that's like how I stumbled on your profile, like people just sharing names of people that are providing information and things that's backed by the literature. But they also present it in a way that's enjoyable. So like I shifted from more of those aesthetic, like pleasing to the eye, like kind of like what I'm doing is working really well, to people that are actually like presenting on like literature and like research articles that show like what's going on. Why this actually works based off statistics and data, not necessarily just here's a picture, here's a transformation,
right,
kind of thing.
Yeah. So basically just asking a few more questions.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah. That's a super, super simple tip, is not taking what you're seeing online as like face value. Asking in that, you ask like one or two more questions to yourself. Like, is this evidence-based? Do they present a way to potentially look up what they're saying, you know, to see if it's going to challenge what they're saying? Yeah. That's a good tip. Sweet.
And I try to take that with a grain of salt too, because some of those people that aren't constantly preaching evidence-based practices are still phenomenal at what they do
as far as
helping people reach their goals. So you kind of just have to be careful and filter what you're taking in. Cause both work,
to
an extent, you know, like it's a science and an art. So I try to balance that as much as I can. And I think it'd be great if people out there did as well.
Because
it's both things at the end of the day, I think.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a good point. I was talking to Joey, who's the other host of the podcast, the other day, and he was saying, you know, to some degree, programming for someone is an art, in the sense of you can have all the knowledge, but if you're scared of applying it, or, you know, you're constantly second guessing it and not just, it boils down to a test retest, you know? Have you heard of Tim Gabbett? Do you know who that is? So Tim Gabbett is a strength and conditioning coach from Australia. He's a CSCS and he has two PhDs. Don't know why or how he has two PhDs. I asked him and he said he's a glutton for pain. He's been on the podcast in the past. I went to one of his workshops in New York City in 2018, and he does, his research was mostly surrounding workload management, and determining, have you heard of the acute on chronic workload ratio? Have you seen
that? I've heard of it. I think we actually covered that in school my first year, like briefly.
Yeah. So what that says is from a standpoint of determining the risk of someone potentially getting injured. And with Tim's research, he's a sports guy. So he does most of his research on team sports from a contextual standpoint. But a lot of the PT trainer world has begun to apply it to individual clients, which I think it's doable. And he works, his main job is working with the Australia national rugby team, but he consults with teams all over the world. Anyway, so he does acute on chronic workload ratio management. And basically what that means is from a risk of injury standpoint, if you have a big spike in what you're doing that you haven't done a lot of in the past, or you haven't done leading up to that, if there's a certain point where there's like the ratio is too high, and then that leaves the athlete susceptible to injury. So it's kind of like an algorithm. I think right now a good example would be quarantine running, right? In the sense of, you know, a lot of lifters don't like to run and only do it haphazardly whenever they're told to. And now because we're in quarantine, you don't have as much stuff, running is always an option unless the government starts putting tanks in the street saying you can't leave your house, right? So a lot more lifters are running more than they have been in the past. So in that sense, if you haven't run in a year and you start running 1 or 2 miles a day, the chance of, like, you just spiked your running workload tremendously, more so than you have in forever. Yeah. Therefore, that's leaving your tissues more susceptible to either developing an overuse or a strain or sprain. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of putting numbers to tracking that. So I think, and I've been talking with my athletes about that with push-ups, because the 10 push-up challenge stuff has been going on. And one day I got like 4 different notifications, yep, of people challenging me. And I was like, this is way more push-ups than most people do at one given time.
Yeah.
So this could start to develop some front of the shoulder pain.
Oh, absolutely. People.
I might run some ads on this when it's all said and done. Do you have quarantine shoulder? So
great idea.
Yeah. We'll see what happens. It's in the works with my marketing guy. But applying that, I mean, that can apply to anything. That's just a quarantine example because it's that time. But that could apply to running. That could apply to lifting. That could apply to someone who's a newer client of yours who hasn't worked out in a very long time. Like, just crushing them on the first day without properly assessing them probably isn't the best idea because – one, they're going to hate you, and two, they haven't, like, their tissues just aren't prepared, right?
Yep.
Have you had anybody similar, like, in that boat, like, super deconditioned, and then you pushed them a little too hard the first day, and you're like, shit?
Yeah, so at the undergrad campus, usually I would get college-age students that I was training.
Yeah.
And then it was probably halfway through the semester, professors are also able to purchase training sessions at the gym, and I got a professor who was in his early 60s that went personal training, and he wanted to transition to barbell training. And so, like, I was first time I'd ever worked with a client in that age range, as far as, like, not necessarily rehab but performance training, you know, progressing. And so I was super hesitant at first. And I was constantly asking for his feedback during that first day, like, does that feel okay? Like, you know, like how's your joints feeling? How's everything feeling? And then I was reaching out to him via email like a day later and 2 days later, asking him like, are your joints hurting? Any swelling? How sore are you?
Yeah.
Cause I really had no idea how he was, cause he hadn't barbell trained before. So I might've been too hesitant, but I would rather with that specific situation.
Oh, for sure.
I would have rather been too hesitant but I worked with him for, I think, 8 weeks before I left for my clinical for PT school, and made some great progress, and he loved where it was going. You know, nice. He was getting up into some pretty decent weight, I would think, for his age group. So
yeah, cool. Yeah, I would say the best thing I found to work around that and be proactive on the front end is setting the expectation prior to starting that, either that assessment or that workout, like saying very clear verbiage, like, you know, you haven't done this in a while and there's a chance that you might get a little flared up or achy after the fact, but it's going to be similar to like a growing pain where you have to give your tissues time to adapt. And in that regard, basically you just need to let me know how you're feeling. We have to have a good line of communication so I don't overload you too soon, right? Because we do have to overload in order to create tissue adaptation, but you can do it in a stepwise fashion that's not going to leave you susceptible to injury. And then if the client's a little bit more analytical, I'll get into a conversation of the acute on chronic workload ratio and giving them an example of that and how that applies to this. But you know, that's reading the client in terms of how you're best going to communicate with them, because some people don't care about that at all. Exactly. They just want to know what to expect, you know?
Yep.
Yeah,
I think that right there is like a great point too, is like reading that client, knowing like how specific do I have to be in explanations and information and literature as far as why I'm doing what I'm doing versus they just, you know, they want to go in there and work out. That's what they want to do. They don't want all the verbiage with that. And I think that's like a great point as far as reading a client.
Yeah. Cause you have to realize you are a trainer or a coach because you really enjoy it. And you're probably to some degree a super nerd when it comes to kinesiology, when it comes to programming, when it comes to movement. And you have to realize that like the context of your client, they might not give two shits about what a serratus anterior is.
Exactly.
Even if you want to explain it to them and you just read an article about how protraction exercises are a really good warm up, and you know, just getting a read on what the person's goals are. You know, I like to ask for permission. Like I find myself, if you ask for permission or ask them if they want to know more and they say yes, well then absolutely you can nerd out with them. But I don't like to just word vomit on people.
Right.
Cause then you might just lose them. And then it's just my face, you know? Yeah. That's another thing that we talk a lot about on the podcast is the mindset of how you're communicating with clients, because that's as much of an art as programming, you know?
Absolutely.
What have you, like in terms of communicating with clients, what has been not your go-to, but your most successful kind of technique, and where have you seen some downfalls?
So the way that training works at the school is we provide a free initial consultation. And basically it's just an hour where it's a whole conversation about what we offer, what their goals are and everything. And I think that initial hour we do is a great way to get a feel for like what their life is outside of the gym, what their goals are in the gym, who they are as a person. And then like I get a chance to kind of explain like how I'm also a student. So I'm kind of like in the same shoes as you are, trying to like just get some familiarity and kind of explain my piece. Just mm-hmm. that initial conversation, I think, does wonders as far as starting that relationship with the client and feeling like how you're going to go forward with that. As far as some of the remote clienting does, usually it's someone that reaches out to me. Mm-hmm. And then, so they're already kind of interested, and then just having that conversation. And I usually try, one thing, a big thing is I try not to just do email. I think it's like at least having a face-to-face interaction. If it's FaceTime or Zoom, Skype, something like that, makes a big difference.
Yeah.
Just getting that familiarity and that connection with the client. So I think those are two big things.
Yeah.
Some downfalls, I would say, is kind of what we hit on previously. I'm still learning how to turn that word vomit filter off, because I want my client to be as informed as possible.
Sure.
So I can find myself sitting there explaining a movement or the reasoning behind why I'm doing this programming for like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
When they really don't care to hear it.
Sure.
And that's definitely a downfall, is I need to realize that like they trust me. They don't mm-hmm. want that 10 minute explanation. They trust me that what I'm doing is going to work for them, and
yeah.
they just want to do it.
Right.
Thing.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I think if you can reframe that to things that you're explaining, if whatever you're explaining or whatever you're having them do is going to make them feel something, or, mm-hmm. you know, if you're explaining a movement and what you're explaining isn't an effort to get them to feel it. Humans are very feel-based, mm-hmm. both from an emotional standpoint and from a physical standpoint. So if you could do both while you're teaching a movement and explain why this is beneficial, and then have them feel it and then have that aha moment, mm-hmm. that's typically as much as you need to do. Right. And that in and of itself is an art. But my a lot of my mentors in the past have always encouraged me with that, because I'm still going through that, because I always want to over explain. But it's a matter of stepping back, getting that reframe going, and then having them feel something. If they can feel one or two things in that first session, then the chance of them being hooked is way higher. And from a financial standpoint, that's better for you, because now you have a client, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, great tip though.
Yeah, that's something that is one of those things that is always going to be changing. Like, you're always mm-hmm. going to have some kind of new client that has a personality that does not fit yours or does not mesh well with yep. you, and you have to meet them where they're at. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. Well, wrapping up, this was a good chat. This was super practical conversation on how to deal with both quarantine peeps as well as new clientele, either virtually or once the dust settles and you're back in person.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man.
I really enjoyed it.
It was fun. So, that's all we have for this week. Next week, we will be diving into more practical tips, and we'll see you then. Thanks for listening, guys.
If you're interested in connecting with us and other coaches around the world, just like you, on a more personal level, join our Facebook group, Alinea Coaches Community, linked in the episode description. Also, if you or a friend who is a trainer are interested in joining us in a podcast, shoot us a message after joining. We'd love to chat.